Jim DeRogatis is pop music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, also the co-host of Sound Opinions, a rock and roll talk show on Chicago Public Radio, and the author of several books on music, including Turn On Your Mind, Four Decades of Psychedelic Rock. He joins us from Chicago Public Radio. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
I'm great. Now, for the record, you were all of 2 years old when Revolver came out. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born in 64. Born the year the Beatles came to America. So I guess 3 years old.
So how do you remember experiencing Revolver for the first time?
I never experienced Revolver when it came out. You know, I'm of the generation, Gen X. There were 17 million of us sandwiched in between the great masses of the baby boom, the largest generation of teenagers in American history, who, of course, grew up with the Beatles as their peers, and their snot-nosed progeny of Gen Y, which is still kind of obsessed with, you know, Britney Spears and Limp Bizkit. I think that the challenge to young people to discover the Beatles, and in particular their best albums, is to get through generations and decades of hype, you know, and the Beatles are ubiquitous in popular culture. You know, they're shoved down our throats in elevator music. You know, they're on commercials. The songs are sold and resold and sold to us again. It's played on classic rock radio, this music, all the time. And I think the great tragedy of the Beatles' artistic legacy is that their best music is not recognized as such in the way that it's sold in the mainstream. You know, pop culture has given to us the unchallengeable fact that Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is their masterpiece. And it's just not the case. You know, released in 67 during, at the height of the Summer of Love, you know, Pepper's got the reputation as being the, pardon the pun, high point of psychedelic rock. In fact, the Beatles had gotten there a year earlier with 1966's Revolver, which I think is not only their best album, but one of the greatest rock albums ever made.
So in some ways, because you didn't, quote, grow up with the Beatles, then you feel like you can assess their music without that emotional baggage.
I didn't grow up with the Beatles, so I didn't have, you know, memories of, you know, you really had to be there. You know, I was 5 years old when Woodstock happened. I've seen the movie. It looked, you know, it doesn't look like fun to me. There's a lot of people rolling in the mud and having sex and doing drugs. It's like, well, you know, I've been to raves in the woods of Hixton, Wisconsin that not only had better drugs and better sex, but better music. Aphex Twin played, and I'll take him over Richie Havens any day. So the Beatles, to me, were this catalog of what I'd been told were incredibly important songs that I could come to fresh. And, you know, even as a listener who was weaned on punk rock and cut my teeth musically as a writer and as a listener and a fan and a musician in the indie rock 80s, you know, the first time I heard Revolver on a scratched up old album, and then when the CD first came out and the first CD pressing, it just blows your mind, because here is this music that is was not only ahead of its time in 1966, but is still ahead of its time today. And I'm talking technologically and melodically and conceptually, basically every which way. You know, it's interesting because the album, of course, is the first that the Beatles recorded when they stopped touring. They had decided that the silliness of Beatlemania had gotten to a point where it hardly mattered for them to perform live anymore. When they would play at Shea Stadium, as they famously did on the American tour, and people screamed at the top of their lungs for the entire time they were on stage, and they had these primitive amplifiers and barely any PA system, it was pointless. You know, why do it anymore? So they were going to concentrate on the recording studio. And, you know, in years since, we've seen a philosophy of approaching the recording studio arise that it all has its roots in Revolver. You know, Revolver opens with the sound of the Beatles inviting you into the studio, basically, you know, counting down 1, 2, 3, 4, and at the beginning of Taxman, and basically saying, you know, hey, we're going to make you aware of the recording process and the fact that this is a studio creation and that we're going to use the studio as an instrument. and make a sort of music that couldn't be duplicated live, not with an orchestra and not with six bands. And that's a fascinating concept. And, you know, the Beatles weren't the first. The Beatles were in this, very competitive race with the Beach Boys. Earlier in 66, the Beach Boys had released Pet Sounds, which is another, incredible album that, uses the studio as an instrument. And, the Beatles felt that wow, you know, we've been knocked on our butts by this American group, in particular Brian Wilson, because the rest of his brothers and the rest of the Beach Boys were out touring, and he was staying at home in the studio in Los Angeles crafting this orchestral pop masterpiece. They decided they were going to give him what for and top Pet Sounds, and I think Revolver does.
So you say in your chapter on the Beatles and Revolver that the Beatles' worldview was changing, and it's evident in the subject matter of some of these songs. Let's hear about some examples from this period that you think exemplify that. And you know, feel free to, you know, spend a moment or two on each song as opposed to listing a bunch of them.
I don't think you can separate the concepts behind the songs in Revolver from their emotional power as music. And what was fascinating to Beatles at this point when they were entering the recording studio in late 1965 was the possibility of transcendence through psychedelic drugs. Now, you know, I wrote a book on psychedelic rock where I tried to draw the line between albums like Pet Sounds and Revolver, and, you know, music today, whether it's the Flaming Lips or My Bloody Valentine or a lot of the rave scene music. I've talked to as many psychedelic rock musicians in all the different meanings of that genre who've said that you had to take psychedelic drugs to make psychedelic rock, as have said, no, I never took psychedelic drugs. It was the spirit of imagination that freed me to make this kind of music. Certainly in Lennon's case, you know, he had experimented a little bit with taking LSD before, but in December of 1965, he had his first profoundly moving psychedelic experience. It sounds almost like a joke today. He was sitting alone in his attic reading Timothy Leary's The Psychedelic Experience, the book that Leary had based on the Tibetan Manual of the Dead and considered a guide to taking the perfect acid trip, traveling toward what Aldous Huxley called the white light, finding God, basically, and, you know, breaking on through to the other side, as Jim Morrison would have said. And this experience reduced Lennon to tears and profoundly moved him and changed his life. And he wrote this song called Tomorrow Never Knows, which was the first song that the Beatles wound up recording for Revolver and the one that I think set the tone for the entire album. Ironically, I mean, I would certainly call it the Beatles' best song. It's an extraordinary piece of music, and yet it's the one that you never, ever, ever hear on classic rock radio or AM pop radio. You basically never hear it, which is interesting. I think that if we were to talk to the general Beatles fan or alleged Beatles fan, they might not even be familiar with this tune. But here is Lennon paraphrasing Leary, paraphrasing the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, saying, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream, basically talking about a voyage of dying, of spiritual transcendence, of going to another world via psychedelic drugs, or just via this music. The music is extraordinary. It's the Beatles at the height of their studio invention. You have these sounds of what sound like backwards bird calls, and this kind of Ringo Starr tribal trance groove. I mean, here we're talking 4 decades before the advent of drum loops and sampling, and Ringo is playing this extraordinarily simple but brilliantly effective groove that just repeats itself and repeats itself with machine-like precision, and it's as if he's hearkening back to any of the ancient shamanic rites of the drumming as a tool for trance, and I think that the guitar sounds are just incredible. It's full of background backwards guitar, and Lennon actually apparently recorded it laying on the floor of Abbey Road studio in the dark, singing up at a microphone that was fed through a revolving Leslie speaker. It's a speaker that's usually used for a Hammond organ, and it revolves as it turns, and the music comes out with this distorted effect. It's an extraordinary piece of music that makes you feel as if you've taken a hit of LSD, when you haven't, just by listening to this song.
Now, a week after they started work on that particular song, they started work on the single Rain, which actually came out before Revolver did. So it was the first, so Beatle fans heard Rain first.
Yeah.
How is Rain a turning point? What's in it that marks a shift?
Rain and Paperback Writer, are considered by many critics to be one of the greatest singles of all time. You know, it's hard to say which is the A side, which is the B side. Theoretically, Rain was the A side, but those are both first class songs, and they showcase wonderfully that Lennon and McCartney parody and competition. You know, Paperback Writer being McCartney's tune and Rain being Lennon's. A lot of people say that a lot of knowledgeable Beatle fans and critics say that the only tragedy of Revolver. As I said, I think it's a perfect album. It could have been even more perfect. And you can do this at home now, thanks to the joys of burning CDs, if Rain and Paperback Writer were included on the album as was originally intended. Would have been an extraordinary, even more powerful record. But Rain, as with Tomorrow Never Knows, shows Lennon musing over psychedelic philosophy. Alan Watts was a philosopher who was very much involved in the psychedelic experience. And, you know, it's naive now. I mean, we have this time where the government has demonized LSD and psychedelic drugs as if they're in the same category as crack cocaine. I mean, let's remember that in 1965, psychiatrists in Canada were treating alcoholics and finding it a miracle cure. To give the alcoholics were taking LSD and beating that disease, and people were taking LSD. Aldous Huxley, the great novelist, wanted to be injected with LSD as he lay dying, and you had great poetry and philosophy and science written about this drug, which was soon to become, outlawed by the government. And so, and partly because it got out of control. You know, I mean, Leary's famous call a year later after the release of Revolver to tune in, turn on, and drop out, was ill-advised. Aldous Huxley had a bit of a snobbish, elitist, attitude. Said, you know, LSD should be something that is taken by artists and intellectuals, professors, poets, painters, and it's not for everybody because not everybody can handle the intensity of this psychedelic experience. And you had Ken Casey of the Merry Pranksters and Tim Leary wanting to basically put it in the water supply and handing out doses of LSD like M&Ms. And a lot of people went on trips and never came back, you know, were burned out, short-circuited permanently. Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys had that experience. But you did have this body of psychedelic literature, like Leary's Tibetan Book of the Dead, reworking in the psychedelic experience, and also Alan Watts' books. And Lennon picked up on Watts' writing and, kind of posing that psychedelic and philosophical question of, you know, how do we really know if it's raining outside, or, you know, can you really prove that you're experiencing this weather? You know, are you really alive? Are you alive or are you dreaming? You know, it goes back to Descartes in a way. And, you know, he spun these lyrics off of that. And again, you have this kind of classically droning melody. There are certain sounds which seem to scream psychedelic or scream, you hear a certain sound and it conjures for you the feeling of meditating or of religion or of, you know, being transported via drugs. And, you know, this is not just in Western music. The gamelan is that kind of trance music, and certain African, instruments and, you know, stuff like the djembe, the drumming, and also, stringed instruments that create that drone. Certainly the Eastern instruments, and you would have George Harrison begin to experiment quite a bit with instruments like the sitar. But Lennon was using all of this and the drone and another great Ringo kind of stuttering rhythm and these lyrics that were spinning off of Alan Watts. And, you know, it came up with a classic in Rain. Whereas McCartney on the B-side was content pretty much to ape the Beach Boys with the harmonies, the staggered harmonies of Paperback Writer. But again, you had Harrison... and Harrison and Lennon seeming to be the big LSD advocates in the Beatles, doing this great droning guitar part. Right.
And then nothing says psychedelic like backwards guitar, which was the first time anybody had heard that, I think. Is that right?
Certainly it was the first time anybody with the popularity of the Beatles had done it. Right. You know, none of this was happening in a vacuum.
Outside of the Beach Boys, which you mentioned, could you talk about that? Because when we talk about inventiveness in music, we're implying that an artist is doing something brand new. Is that really true in this case? Were the Beatles listening to other things that you hear coming up in Revolver that weren't there before?
The Beatles get credit for, you know, inventing everything under the sun, and certainly that wasn't the case. And I think that when you're not a student of history and you're not realizing, you know, what was happening simultaneously to them recording Revolver or any of their albums, you know, it's easy to think, well, the Beatles did this first just because they did it and it was most popular. But, you know, in America, you'd had a wave of psychedelic garage bands, many of whom had never taken LSD because it simply wasn't available in places like Portland, Oregon, or you know, even Chicago. You had bands that were writing songs that they thought conjured the sound and experience of taking psychedelic drugs, but they might not have ever had them themselves. I mean, some of them did, for sure.
Okay, 1965 and early 66, can you give some examples?
Yeah, of course. I mean, in Austin, Texas, of all places, you had the psychedelic sounds of the 13th Floor Elevators, which was the first album which was beginning to end, and including the title, dedicated to trying to capture on vinyl the sound and experience, use music as a tool to create the feeling of taking psychedelic drugs. Rocky Erickson had one of the greatest voices in rock history, and that's early 66, late 65. There's a great album that Lenny Kaye, later of the Patti Smith Band, and at the time an amateur rock critic, in 1971 compiled called Nuggets, Facts of the First Psychedelic Era, where he compiled all those great one-hit wonder psychedelic garage bands of 65 and 66, and groups like the Moving Sidewalks, who had a guitarist named Billy Gibbons, would go on to form ZZ Top, and the Seeds of Pushing Too Hard fame, and the 13th Floor Elevators, and the Amboy Dukes, which was Ted Nugent's first band. He was 16 or 17 years old. He'd never taken psychedelic drugs. Claims to this day he never took any drugs, but yet they had this song, Journey to the Center of the Mind. So the Beatles were aware of people who were either taking psychedelic drugs and making music that tried to replicate that experience, or were just trying to sound psychedelic in this vein. As I said, they were also very much aware of a competition with the Beach Boys. McCartney loved Motown, and so Got to Get You Into My Life is his distinct attempt to do a Motown song.
All right, let's pause here. By my count, we've got about 10 minutes left. So since you're starting to mention some song titles, let's kind of do a little speed round here, and maybe ask you to pick about half of the tunes, the ones that you know you'd like to talk about the most, and just give me about 2 minutes of you know, analysis, feeling that you draw from these particular tunes that you're impressed with on this record. And let's give me another line or two about Got to Get You Into My Life. I've often heard people say, okay, this is McCartney's, you know, Motown nod. Tell me more about how that comes through.
Got to Get You Into My Life, obviously, with the brass, is a very conscious effort for McCartney to do Motown soul. And I think it's one of the slightest songs on Revolver, but you know, you hear this song, it explodes out of your speakers. It's got this undeniable energy that it's just testament to how great the rest of Revolver is to say that's one of the lesser songs. I think McCartney is really shown at his best light. You know, he's had a a difficult career to assess, because the man has given us more irredeemable schlock and, you know, unrepentant cheese in the last 30 years than almost anybody else in popular music. I mean, he's written some truly crappy and despicable songs. And it all comes from the ability not being able to edit himself. You know, the guy is cheesy and corny. But on Revolver, whether it was the competition with Lennon or Lennon's cynicism balancing McCartney's kind of Hallmark card banality, you get McCartney at his best. So, you know, a song like For No One is this incredibly poignant love song that George Martin, the Beatles producer, decorates with just the absolutely perfect touch of French horn. And it's McCartney seemingly speaking from his heart, as opposed to, you know, writing bad sophomore poetry. Eleanor Rigby, the same thing. I mean, McCartney steps out of himself and paints a portrait of people who are falling apart in society, who have nobody.
Let me ask you to back up, Al, because I probably won't use these in consort. So don't say Eleanor Rigby the same thing, but just pick up your stream of thought. But say, you know, in Eleanor Rigby, blah.
In Eleanor Rigby, you see McCartney as an amateur sociologist, painting these very moving and poignant portraits of people who are isolated and completely cut off in society on their own, basically whom society has forgotten. And I think that's interesting at this point of baby boomer hubris, you know, summer of love, you know, we have the power, we are the promised people, that you see McCartney feeling sorry for this old preacher, parson, sitting alone mending his socks, or Eleanor Rigby, this basically an old maid, to use a politically probably incorrect term, who's going to die alone and has no friends. And you know, I mean, wow, here's this guy in his mid-20s who is one of the richest, most famous, and most sexually wanted people in his generation, and he's worrying about basically old Londoners who nobody cares for. I think that's a great piece of songwriting. And, you know, George Harrison also would often go off the deep end. I think when he does his Indian forays on Sgt. Pepper's, they're self-indulgent, and they just smack of, like, George, you know, what are you doing here? You're not Ravi Shankar, and if we wanted Ravi Shankar, we'd listen to Ravi Shankar. Whereas on Revolver, which is the first time he really got a chance to do some serious songwriting and was given space on a Beatles album, you know, Love You Too, I think, is his best Eastern Raga experiment, because it's the most rock and roll. You know, Harrison, like all the Beatles, was a guy who was weaned on 50s rockabilly. And what he's doing is taking this Eastern sounding sitar and putting it over just kind of this frantic rock and roll groove, which I love. He's gotten crap, Harrison, for being the most materialistic of the Beatles, which is ironic, because when he died a few years ago, we honored him as the most spiritual of the Beatles. But with Taxman, at the time it was heard as you know, George complaining that the government was taking too much of his paycheck. But really, it also was the first time on album that the Beatles specifically questioned authority. They hadn't done that yet. They hadn't taken pot shots. I mean, this is well before Revolution and, you know, Piggies. And Harrison is singing, he's answering in the form of the government, you know, why do I have to pay taxes? And the government is kind of, you know, telling him, don't ask me what we wanted for. And he's wondering, you know, why am I funding this? And of course, you know, I'm funding this government against the background of the wars in East Asia at the time.
Okay, so how much time do we have, Mary, roughly, before our half hour expires?
We have about 6 more minutes.
6 more minutes, okay. Well, let me ask you to continue, Al. Do you want me to prompt you on some song titles, or do you
I want to give you what you need.
Okay. Let's see. I probably won't have too many people talking about Dr. Robert, which is, well, I won't prejudice you. I'm just interested in what you have to say about that. I'll call out about 3 more titles, and then we'll close down here.
Dr. Robert is interesting. Again, you know, the Beatles have been sanitized by popular culture in recent years. You know, it's the lovable mop top image that has prevailed, and you know, we forget how truly on the cutting edge of society and popular culture they were in 66 at the time of Revolver. Dr. Robert is kind of a jaunty throwaway musically, but the lyrics are fascinating because they're about the methadrine speed dispensing notorious Dr. Feelgood of New York City's Warhol scene at that point. I think that's fascinating. Even Yellow Submarine, which is often considered basically a children's sing-along ditty, Albert Goldman, Lennon's in some quarters most reviled biographer, because he dared to say that Lennon was, you know, a human being and a very troubled and messed up one. He contended that Yellow Submarine was written about yellow sub-shaped, you know, tubular Nembutal pills. That Lennon was actually making this perverse comment with a children's song, once again on drugs. The other, along with Tomorrow Never Knows, the song that blows my mind every single time I hear it is She Said, She Said, which Lennon wrote based on his first acid trip. Now, the one that was profoundly moving and inspired Tomorrow Never Knows, he traveled toward the white light, he met God, right? The first time he took acid was a complete bummer, to use the parlance of the time. He found himself in a hot tub with the actor Peter Fonda and a couple of members of the Byrds in Los Angeles, and Fonda had just had minor surgery, and as some people do when they're on acid, couldn't stop babbling about this near-death experience he allegedly had during surgery. You know, I know what it's like to be dead. And Lennon picked up these lines and wrote the song based on this, being stuck in a hot tub with a babbling Peter Fonda. It's just amazing to me, you know, when I watch these biographies of the Beatles on PBS, you know, during Pledge Drive, you know, they never tell these stories, you know, they never tell the good stories. They talk about Lennon, they talk about the band being pelted with jelly beans.
So that leaves, let's see, Good Day Sunshine, And I Want to Tell You. Oh, And Your Bird Can Sing, And I Want to Tell You. You want to pick one or two of those to round out here with?
Well, I think the remaining songs on the album, Good Day Sunshine, I Want to Tell You, And Your Bird Can Sing, are mostly interesting for the music. And Your Bird Can Sing, in particular, the way that acoustic 12-string guitar just, it kind of explodes out of your speakers. You know, the Beatles were recording on 4-track. It's amazing. You know, today with digital recording technology, the studio I'm sitting in, I mean, we could do 164 tracks of me on top of myself, you know, and I could sound like the a choir, you know, at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, for God's sake. Beatles didn't have that, you know. It was basically a tin can and a string, comparatively speaking. And the way the guitars sound on And Your Bird Can Sing, or the rhythm section on I Want to Tell You, again, another kind of Motown groove, showing that these guys, you know, they had come from American R&B, and they never completely lost that, even as they were truly coming into their own sound. But every song on the album, from beginning to end, is notable musically, lyrically, or both. I think it's an extraordinary album and a perfect album. And, you know, there's an irony we forget, but the title was meant to play on the concept of a 12-inch vinyl record revolving on your turntable. Kids today have no idea what that is. You know, MP3s don't move, you know. Once again, the Beatles drawing attention to this concept of, we have made this piece of art in the studio that could not have been made outside of a studio. It existed, you know, only with us in front of the microphones with that 4-track rolling. And I think, you know, one of the first albums that the beginning to end was considered as an album, where every track was going to take you somewhere different and convey different moods and take you on this journey. And for my money, infinitely, it does it 100 million times better than Sgt. Pepper's.
Jim DeVirgatis is co-host of Sound Opinions, a rock and roll talk show on Chicago Public Radio, also the pop music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. Jim, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Sure, sure. I hope you got what you need, Paul.